Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, may it please the Court. My name is Norman Thomas, and I represent Mr. Reginald Way in this appeal that arises from a guardianship and conservatorship petition in the Virginia Beach Circuit Court. Mr. Way's position is that on October 24, 2014, the trial court erroneously and prejudicially refused a continuance of the hearing in the case, that which is referred to in the record as a trial, and he was denied his due process rights to be heard on statutorily mandated issues under Virginia Code Section 64.2, 2003, 2007, and 2008.
Mr. Thomas, you need to use your time however you want, but I want you to know that I'm very interested to know about this shadow docket that is existing in this court system.
I'll be happy to.
And how that relates to your claim.
And, Mr. Chief Justice, may I also reserve 5 minutes at this time
Yes.
for rebuttal? The shadow docket that we have referred to, it works like this. The judges of the Virginia Beach Circuit Court, and in this particular instance, the judge that heard this case, directed counsel at the end of a hearing in August 18, 2014, to go to see his assistant, Mrs. Cato, and pick the next date for the hearing. They did what they were told. They went and they saw Ms. Cato, and they set the hearing for October the 24th. At that point in time, like 4 days later, Mr. Hunt, the competing petitioner, Mrs. Way's son, filed a hearing notice. The clerk received it and date stamped it received on the 22nd of August. Mr. Way filed one the next month, September 22nd. Date stamp received is filed by the clerk. 2 weeks before the hearing, Mr. Way's trial counsel seeks subpoenas, and the clerk takes the position that the judge's office did not properly tell them of the October 24th hearing, and therefore they don't see it. It's not there. They refuse to acknowledge it. And they
did
do
that
so.
Did that happen contemporaneously with the request, or is that your characterizing of what happened in retrospect? Did he go to the clerk and say, I want to have subpoenas issued, and they say, no, we don't have a case?
Yes. Appendix pages 294 through 296 is the post-hearing exceptions filed by Mr. Way's trial counsel. And it includes that very thing where she says that there was a 2 or 3 days of telephone tag, and finally she went down to the clerk's office in person. At that point, it's the 20th of October, 4 days before the hearing. And they told her specifically that this particular judge has his own docket and they didn't hear about it. And that's notwithstanding the fact that there were hearing notices in the file that was available to both the court and the clerk's office. And they simply took the position that they were not going to acknowledge it. And counsel was completely unsuccessful in resolving that issue.
She called opposing counsel as well, didn't she, and say, you know, this is what I've heard. Counsel said something along the lines of, well, you misunderstand.
She said the clerk was misinformed, and that, I believe, is on page 295 of the appendix. And the next page, she says that she then, this is Mr. Way's trial counsel, unsuccessfully attempted to get a pretrial conference call scheduled. So it isn't a matter where she just sat on her hands until the day of the hearing and sprung this on everybody that day.
Counsel, what was the timeline between the clerk's attempts to reach counsel on the day that the subpoena request hit the clerk's office? There's a notation that they attempted to reach counsel on the 14th and again on the 16th. When was the first time that Ms. Crump responded to their attempts to reach her?
First, I'll say there's an incongruence between the recitation of the judge at the beginning of the January 8th hearing.
And I understand that. I'm just looking at the notations
Crump,
on the letters that would indicate attempts to reach Ms. Crump.
looking at the record from what best consensus you can reach there is that on approximately the 14th or the 16th, there was an initial message left. Then there was a second message left, I believe, on the 16th. There was a call back on the 17th. And there was a visit to the clerk's office to try to resolve the matter on the 20th of October.
And was it the 17th or the 20th?
I believe Ms. Crump indicates that it was the 20th of the month that she actually went in person to the Virginia Beach Circuit Court Clerk's Office.
At JA 60, there would be a notation on a letter from Ms. Crump indicating a telephone call from Ms. Crump. So there's a discrepancy between Ms. Crump and the clerk's office as to when the contact was made.
There's not an exact congruence. The point we would raise in that is that whether it was the 14th or the 16th or the 17th, the compression of time before the hearing was such that even if the matter had been resolved, even if the clerk said, oh, you're right, we see these hearing notices, we'll issue the subpoenas, it was less than 5 days before the hearing by the time there was any face-to-face and personal discussion of this where a resolution could have been reached.
But a resolution could have been reached before the five-day interlude by the attorney. You weren't counsel at that point, were you?
No, Your Honor. I'm appellate counsel.
Couldn't counsel, under statutory provisions, have issued the subpoenas himself?
That's true. However, I anticipated that question. I want to make a couple of points on that. First, when the clerk's telling you there is no hearing on the docket, then to issue the subpoenas yourself is a defiant act. And secondly, very likely, if you're wrong, that you're going to have issued these subpoenas, paid for a private process server, had doctors all ready to cancel their appointments and come to court, and it's for nothing. So when the clerk tells you there is no hearing at all, then that becomes somewhat of a, not only a risky, but a highly potentially pointless act to do.
Well, but counsel, can I ask you a question along those lines?
Yes.
I didn't see anything in the record where, not you, but trial counsel, called the Miss, what did you say her name was, Miss Coe, or whoever the assistant was to the judge, and said, the clerk's office doesn't have any record of this. When she was notified by phone, or at least attempted to, on both the 4th and the 16th of the month. 14th and 16th, I'm sorry.
No, she did not go back. There's no record that she went back to the judge's assistants.
Okay.
She went to the clerk's office, which, of course, was the source of the refusal to issue the subpoenas, and then went to opposing counsel and tried to state her case there, and they said, well, the clerk is just mistaken, the hearing is on. And the interesting thing is, opposing counsel was right. The hearing was on. And then all that has led to this appeal happened at the very beginning of that hearing.
Well, counsel, along those lines, let me ask you these questions. I realize there were about 10 or 11 subpoenas that she wanted to have issued. And it appears from the record pretty clearly that the trial court early on said that he found nothing that there was that Mr. Way would be not fit to be a guardian. So he wasn't going to question his fitness to be appointed the guardian. What I'm trying to find out is, of all these people that she wanted to testify, at some point Ms. Crump said, I could dismiss some of them. A Mr. Farmer, who was one of the, I guess, a character witness, you'd say, was actually at the hearing and was not called. Mr. Way, of course, had the opportunity to speak. Ms. DeBastiani, I believe was her name, again, was called. Ernestine Stewart wouldn't come because she's a government. The record, I think, what says that she was a government. But some of these other people, what would they add? What would they have added to the position of Mr. Way?
Well, I'd like to clarify a couple of things and answer the question. The court stated that it would not find him unfit as a guardian, but it never allowed that it would find him to be appropriate as a guardian. It just said it wasn't going to hold against him the false remarks or the innuendo that had been asserted against him. Yet when he sought to introduce evidence of his own fitness, the court cut counsel off. And there are two, perhaps three, areas of the appendix that are critical to that. Pages 89 and 90, pages 100 and 101, and then pages 115 through approximately 122, when the court threatens counsel with contempt. And what the point the court was making is that I'm not interested, were the court's words, in anything historical, anything other than the GAL's recommendation for Mrs. Way's palliative day-to-day care. And that left out a number of inquiries. First of all, Mr. Way was entitled to be heard under 2007B.
But he was.
He was allowed to speak to the court from the gallery. And that's one of the concerns we did raise in the brief. Other than receiving the GAL report and Dr. Wang's medical report, no witness ever was sworn. They were permitted just to speak from the gallery.
Did Ms. Crump, the trial attorney, try and have him sworn as a witness? Did she ask for that?
Well, I would submit this. The judge asked her a second time at page 115 of the appendix to proffer what she wanted to prove. And when she started to go into anything other than the single issue that the judge was willing to hear, he cut her off. And that colloquy led to the threat of contempt. He was not able to show, for example, one of the statutory factors under 2007C is steps necessary to avoid abuse or neglect or exploitation of the incapacitated person. Exhibit 1 contains a number of Navy Federal Credit Union records that show that in this period of incapacity that Mrs. Way's finances were being utilized. There's even a charge in there on page 231 of the appendix where someone used her credit card at the soccer store in Virginia Beach. Well, she's an unlikely soccer player. And there's questions raised there that would have at least indicated there needed to be some kind of financial accounting for this period of time between June of 2013 and the hearing when the order was finally entered in 2015.
But wasn't a different conservator appointed?
Jewish Family Service was appointed ultimately. They hadn't qualified until the early 2015, and they had no mandate whatsoever to look into that period of time. That was not a part of the court order.
You wanted to reserve some time. You have a minute.
I do, and
34 seconds.
I will come back and rebuttal and respond to the second half of Your Honor's question as well. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mandy Rogers, and I represent the appellee, Reginald Damian Hunt. I'm asking this court to affirm the trial court's decision because the trial court did not err when it refused to grant Mr. Way's counsel's request for a continuance. As this court is aware, in order to reverse a motion to continue...
But it seems the trial judge, the reason he wouldn't grant the continuance is not because... truly the mix-up of the clerk's office is the trial judge didn't appreciate there were cross petitions, that he had to choose between competitors for this conservator slot. He seemed to only think that the question going forward was, does this lady need a conservator? Well, of course she did. That was conceded. But the husband wanted to put on his case that he was the proper person. The aunt and the son wanted to put on their case that they were the proper people. How could the trial judge not hear from one side of the case when it was competitors for the same appointment?
Well, my argument would be that no one offered to present any witnesses. There were several witnesses that were missing the day of trial. Mrs. Attorney Crump had subpoenaed or attempted to subpoena approximately 11 witnesses. And of those, at least three were present in the courtroom. In addition to the three witnesses that were present from her list, there were also the cross-petitioner, Reginald Daniel Hunt.
But trial counsel went right to the brink of being held in contempt to try to get her case put on. She came that close to being held in contempt. How much more can we expect of a lawyer in a trial court?
I would respond that she never attempted to even call a witness. She didn't ask the trial court to call a witness. She proffered a lot of testimony that the court found to be irrelevant. And going to the brink...
Isn't that your problem, that the court found it to be irrelevant when there were these competing petitions?
No, I don't think so. Because for there to be an abuse of discretion, first the court would have had to have considered or given significant weight to an irrelevant factor, or would have refused to consider a relevant factor, or could properly consider all of the factors but still arrived at a clear error. And in addition to that, there would have needed to be some prejudice to the movement. And in this case, there is no prejudice to the movement because there is no relevancy in the witnesses that he was attempting to subpoena. The trial court actually went through the list of each witness that was missing and found that none of their testimonies would be relevant to the issue.
But doesn't that go back to what Justice Kelsey was saying? He thought none of it was relevant because he only seemed to be concerned about whether or not she was competent. Well, he didn't seem to appreciate the fact that there was a decision as to who was going to be her guardian between her son and her, I guess, sister and her husband. He seemed like, well, I don't care about that. I don't want to hear any of that. I just want to do these other things.
I read it a little differently, Your Honor. I read that the issue of her competency was clear from the beginning. It was clear from the guardian ad litem's report, supplemental report. It was also clear from the medical evaluation that had been introduced earlier in that trial. And so
what was the judge doing at the hearing? I mean, if all these other things were irrelevant, what was he trying to resolve?
He was trying to resolve who would be in the best position to provide day-to-day care for the respondent, Mrs. Way.
So why would it be relevant who had been taking care of her before?
Because the list of witnesses weren't necessarily who had been taking care of her before. The list of witnesses involved, for instance,
But remember, the judge said, I don't care about what's happened historically. I'm worried about things prospectively.
Correct.
So how's he going to make that decision when he's only looking at the future?
Well, he was looking at her day-to-day care, who was in the best position to care for her day-to-day. And the witnesses that were offered, none of them really were going to be able to present any evidence as to who would be the best to care for Mrs. Way day-to-day. For instance, Dr. Wang, that was a witness who was only going to testify about Mrs. Way's condition, and the court found that wasn't relevant. It wasn't necessary. Her condition had already been proven. There were several witnesses that were from Adult Protective Services that were going to talk about the very beginning when Mrs. Way was at home alone, left alone, and the judge said that wasn't relevant because he wasn't going to find that Mr. Way had neglected or abused his wife. So the court found that all of the proffered witnesses, they just weren't relevant to the issue of Mrs. Way's day-to-day care. And I would like for a moment to address the shadow docket issue. There is just nothing in the record that leads anyone to accept the fact that there's a shadow docket system. A shadow, the word itself denotes there's some type of secrecy, that the court is hiding its docket.
Well, if the clerk doesn't know it, isn't that exactly what it is?
No, I think that could have just been a miscommunication between the clerk. That particular clerk. The issue is that the court on August 18th was very clear in its instructions. Go and see my assistant. She will put this on the calendar. And Attorney Crump and all the other attorneys did do that. They went, they met with the assistant, they scheduled it. So Mrs. Crump knew.
Put it on what calendar?
They put it on the trial court's calendar.
Well, what about the trial court? Is the trial court judge's calendar or the trial court's calendar?
I think they're one and the same. I think
so. Why didn't the clerk know about it then?
I can't answer why the clerk wouldn't know about it. The clerk that Mrs. Crump talked to, or the clerk that sent the letter, or tried to call Mrs. Crump. I don't understand why she didn't know about it. Everyone else knew that the case was on the docket. It was clear that the case was going to be heard on October 24th. That's why both counsels sent notice of hearing for that date.
Well, if somebody from the public wanted to come and they went to the clerk's office and they said, "I want to watch this case." How would they know?
Well, I think it would depend on which clerk they spoke to, quite frankly. I'm not sure that the clerk that Mrs. Crump spoke to was correct in saying that it wasn't on the docket. I'm not sure what miscommunication happened, but I don't think that there exists a shadow docket that's intended to prevent people from knowing which cases are on the docket. I think what happened is that Judge Lilly was going to hear the case. He continued the case and sent everyone up to his personal assistant, and then the personal assistant maybe didn't communicate that to the clerk that Mrs. Crump later spoke to.
Okay, now, counsel, on Joint Appendix page 309, when the judge is reciting the history of what happened, if you look at lines 9 through 16, he says on October 20th, the same day Ms. Crump called back and said there was no hearing scheduled, but she would call the clerk back when a hearing was to be scheduled. That was on the 20th. On the 21st, the clerk mailed Ms. Crump's checks back to her for the subpoenas. The clerk never heard from Ms. Crump again after the 20th. The hearing was set for the 24th. Appellant's counsel said that's not an accurate statement of facts. What do you say about that?
My understanding of the timeline for the subpoenas is that Attorney Crump sent the first request, which was for 10 subpoenas, on October 10th. On October 14th, the clerk then made a phone call to Mrs. Crump's office, left a voicemail telling her that they didn't have the case on the docket. That would have been approximately 10 days. That would have been exactly 10 days before the trial was scheduled. Plenty of time to correct this issue. Then Mrs. Crump sent another letter requesting an additional subpoena on October the 12th. That letter came in. The clerk made another phone call on October the 16th. So this was her second phone call. The first was October 14th. The second was October the 16th. Left another voice message for Attorney Crump. Then it gets kind of confusing because Attorney Crump says that she called the clerk. If you look at the appendix on page 295, she says that she found out on October 17th that the subpoenas didn't go out, and she called and spoke to the clerk that day. But the clerk, if you look at Joint Appendix pages 308 through 309, the clerk says that she didn't receive a phone call from counsel until October 20th, 4 days before. So,
well, that's what the court says the clerk.
Correct. And the clerk was there that day, and the court asked if either counsel wanted to question the clerk about that issue. And Attorney Crump didn't question that. So the clerk stated through the court that October 20th was the first time that Attorney Crump returned the phone call. I mean, that is 4 days.
May I interrupt
days.
You there? The January 8th hearing, was that called sua sponte?
It was, yes. And it was in response to Attorney Crump's exceptions to the order.
And did the trial court give either counsel notice that the clerk would be present and presented to counsel? Well,
I don't believe he did.
Husband's attorney said, look, I feel blindsided, and you can sort of understand why an attorney might come to that conclusion. What are we to make of that?
Well, once she said that she was blindsided and there were issues of attorney's fees, husband's counsel then asked to have it continued, and another hearing was scheduled for February the 8th. And so at that time, she would have been able to present any issues. The order wasn't entered prior to that. The order wasn't actually entered until March. So on the February 8th hearing, she had the opportunity to present any questions that she had at that time that had been raised at the January hearing, and she failed to do so. The issue that I was making with the timeline with the subpoenas is that the attorney should have known 10 days before trial that there was an issue with the subpoenas. The clerk called and left a message, and she didn't appropriately address that issue. She didn't go to the court until October 20th. She didn't contact Mrs. Cato directly and ask, why isn't this showing up on the docket? It could have been addressed with a simple phone call to the judge's assistant, and the judge himself pointed that out. We could have addressed this with a simple phone call.
Well, why wouldn't the phone call come from the clerk's office? I've got a lawyer in here who says they got a hearing in front of you, Judge Lilly. Do they? I need to decide whether or not I need to issue the subpoenas. Why would you expect the public to communicate between the clerk and the judge's chambers as opposed to them doing it themselves?
I think that's an excellent point and would have probably solved everything. However, I do think that the attorneys in the case had an obligation to make sure that the case they had sent notices of hearings on was appropriately docketed, and that the subpoenas that she requested were going to be addressed and sent out. And she did have other opportunities to send the subpoenas. She could have issued those subpoenas with a private process server well in advance of the 4 days if she had returned her phone calls in a timely manner. She didn't use her due diligence to ensure that her witnesses were there, and that was the main reason that the court denied the request for a continuance. In addition to that, the court found that the witnesses weren't relevant. They weren't going to add anything to the husband's case. So in order to reverse the decision, there would need to be an abuse of discretion plus a prejudice to the movement. In this case, there's neither. Trial court didn't abuse its discretion. It went through each witness, listened to the proper testimony, and decided it wasn't relevant to the issues that the court felt were important to decide. And then, at the same time, there was no prejudice because Mr. Way still had the opportunity to present evidence. He himself could have been called as a witness. He had an opportunity to address the court and didn't use that opportunity to present any evidence about his suitability to be guardian or conservator, or about the other party's unsuitability to be guardian or conservator. Instead, he complained about the other party. He also had an opportunity to call witnesses that were present in the courtroom. He didn't call any witnesses. His attorney just continued to argue with the judge to the point that she was almost held in contempt of court. She was so focused on presenting medical history that the court had already determined wasn't relevant that she failed to provide any information to the court on behalf of her client, any relevant information. For that reason, I would ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Thomas, rebuttal.
The purpose of Rule 1:15 about the approval by this court of local rules is to make sure that there is transparency in whatever is to be done.
But how do we know this is not just a one mistake, a miscommunication? The shadow docket implies that this is a continuing thing.
Well, the clerk's explanation to Ms. Crump that she detailed in her exceptions indicated, by inference, Your Honor, but I think a fair reading of it, is that sometimes they don't hear about these hearings. And when they don't, they will not issue subpoenas. And so I would submit that to the court. I believe it's pages 294 through 296.
But the judge says Ms. Crump called back and said there was no hearing scheduled, and she would call the clerk back when a hearing was to be scheduled.
Well, there are some differences there. Ms. Crump never says that she acknowledged that there was no hearing. In fact, on the 24th, at the very beginning of her remarks, around page 65...
But how do we factor this in the abuse of discretion standard?
This way. Looking at it globally, and this responds to the Chief Justice's question, too, she had committed down a path to get her subpoenas issued. The first call, she indicated, was not one that explained what the problem was. The clerk just said, call us, and it was a couple of days later. None of this is Mr. Way's fault. He's caught in between a firestorm between the clerk's office and the court. He can't resolve it. His attorney can't resolve it. And when she gets to court and she's trying to make these proffers, the court is so unwilling to hear it that it threatens her with a criminal conviction that will last for the rest of her life. And there she is trying to preserve the record on the one hand, which is her obligation, and not go to jail that afternoon, which is certainly a laudable desire. And she can't fight her way through it. So, some passion in my answer, Your Honor, but it is this. Mr. Way had been cut off from his wife for over a year and wanted a fair hearing on the issue of who's suitable, whether she should be in a memory care facility, who's using her money, and he could never get through to make the first presentation on that issue. And I have very little time, but I will refer the court.
Has he answered your question? All right, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Yes,
call the next case.
We ask for a reversal.